Welcome to Political Rewind, our first edition since Irma blew through the state. We're going to talk about Irma and move on to a lot of other political issues during the show today. My voice is still a little shaky. I want to thank Bradley George, who on Friday filled in for me, because on Friday I couldn't talk at all. I hope you'll bear with me throughout the show today. Beth Shapiro and Todd Rehm are here, and we'll talk politics in a little while with Daniel Rauschberg, a new member of our panel. But first, we have an opportunity to talk briefly with Governor Deal about where things stand now with Irma. So, Governor, thank you so much for being with us on Political Rewind.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's nice to hear from you, and look forward to your questions.
You know, I'm thinking, have you had any sleep in the last 3 days? Is this like the perfect time to ask you really tricky questions that you may not be as alert for?
Well, fortunately, I have not had to have the inconveniences that perhaps some of our citizens have had who have lost power. We did lose power here at the mansion, but we did have a backup generator.
Yeah.
And, of course, many people in their private residences don't have that. So, no, I'm in good shape.
Well, good for you. Let me start by you. We played a short soundbite from your news conference yesterday in which you said that this storm was kind of like unlike anything that we'd seen sweep across Georgia before. What do you mean exactly by that? How is this different?
Well, first of all, the scope of it and the geographical area that was embraced by the hurricane and the tropical storm, this is the first time that I am aware of that any governor has declared the entire state of Georgia, all 159 counties, for an emergency declaration. We did that, and it was accepted and approved by the federal government. That, I think, illustrates the magnitude and the spread of the effects of this hurricane. Most of the damage, of course, has been in these widespread areas, has been because of trees being down and power lines being disrupted and leaving a substantial portion of our population without power. Our utility companies have been working very hard. In fact, I was just told a few minutes ago that Georgia Power has restored power in the last 24 hours to some 590,000 of their customers, but there are still those that are without power.
Yeah, it's astonishing that at one point, George Power said, as many as a million or more people in the state were without power.
And there are still hundreds of thousands that are without power, I'm sure, but they have restored that many within a 24-hour period of time, which to me is a remarkable number. Now, on the coast, we had what I consider a little bit of an unusual situation. We had just been through Matthew, as you know, just a month or so ago, and the storm surge from Matthew was not nearly as significant as the storm surge from Irma. Part of it was because Matthew came at low tide and Irma did not, but it appears that our lower coast, the Camden County area, was the largest hit by storm surge. And, of course, the same thing is true for Florida, just below Camden County.
Yes.
in the Jacksonville area. Understand they were the second hardest hit area of Florida, second only to the Keys. So there was a huge influx of storm water coming into those parts of the Florida coast as well as that part of Georgia. And all up our coast, we had higher amounts of storm surge coming back into those parts of our state.
You, yesterday, speaking of the coast and the damage it sustained, yesterday around 11 o'clock in the morning, I think, lifted the mandatory evacuation for those counties along the coast. But you did it with the caution that local municipalities would have to approve for each of their cities, residents coming back. So I guess it's a double question. First of all, what led you yesterday to realize that you could offer the opportunity for people to come back home? And are now all of the local communities along there accepting their residents back?
I don't know the answer to the second part of that question, but it is important that we understand the sequence of events here. One is we did order a mandatory evacuation for those areas that were east of I-95, because that was the areas where we expected the flooding to occur the heaviest, and that is what happened. We were able to do what the state's obligations were, and that is to inspect the roads and bridges in those evacuation areas before we could give the agreement from the state's standpoint for them to reenter. The second part that you just alluded to is local jurisdictions that have responsibilities for their own roads and streets have to agree to let these people back in. And there were still some areas of our evacuation area that I understand had not been given full consent for their people to return, but that is a local jurisdiction decision.
Sure.
And we honor that.
So the next question, of course, becomes, as you pointed out, you've gotten a federal declaration of emergency status for every county in Georgia. How do you begin to assess the amount of federal aid that you will request from Washington? And do you have any sense at all yet of what that figure could end up being?
No idea as to the dollar amount on it yet, Bill. We will have our assessment teams, I'm sure they're out there now, making the preliminary estimates so that we can make that submission. Now, there are threshold requirements for the amount of loss that you must have happen to you in order to qualify for federal emergency assistance. That is true for both the public side of things as well as on the individual side of things. So those assessments are really going to be determinative of the total amount of federal assistance that we will get. But those are going to be ongoing and will be submitted as soon as that information is received.
So, Governor, one of the things that we all watched during this particular storm was you have a brand new, you've really had the first opportunity for your newer emergency management team to take on a weather crisis of this magnitude. We all remember that Snow Jam was not one of the parts of your administration you want to look back on fondly. And from all accounts, things seem to move pretty well. There haven't been a great many complaints that we've heard in our newsroom, at least. Are you pleased that you have a team in place that can now handle this sort of thing?
Yes, I'm very pleased with the work of our team. They certainly work well together. And let me just reiterate some of those agencies, state agencies, that are involved in this process. Of course, first is GEMA. That's our Georgia Emergency Management Agency. Our Georgia National Guard, our Georgia Department of Transportation, our Department of Natural Resources, and our Department of Public Safety. So those are a lot of state employees, and I want to thank all of them for their overtime work and their deliberate times that they have spent away from their families trying to help others in our state. And I believe the results were very positive, and I thank them for that.
Governor, I know we need to let you go in a second, but I can't let you leave without just one political question in regard to the storm. And you know this already. In crises like Irma, like Harvey, the amount of federal aid that's going to be required rubs up directly against concerns in Washington, mostly by Republicans, about running up the federal deficit, about spending priorities. And I'm curious how you yourself, there's no question that the Republican delegation, that the entire Georgia congressional delegation is going to want to get money here to help us. But there are also people who are very conservative. And I wonder how you think through the need for federal funds in a crucial time like this, as opposed to concerns about federal spending, the deficit growing as a result of all this. How do you think through that in a time like this?
Well, I think that these are situations where political considerations sometimes have to take a very distant second seat. This is a time to deal with the crisis, to try to restore a state's economy, and try to restore the lives of individuals. And that is one of the functions that government has. It's a legitimate function of government. And I'm appreciative of the fact that Congress has already acted with regard to these hurricane disasters and already decided to appropriate a substantial sum of money for assistance in that regard. We do not ask for things that we do not need. And I believe that is true in most of these kinds of emergencies, is that we don't over-ask. And if you don't over-ask, people pay a lot more attention when you do ask.
Governor Deal, we really appreciate your taking some time. I know it's a very busy week for you. So thank you so much for talking to us on Political Rewind. I hope you and all of your people get some rest over the days ahead.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Governor Nathan Deal talking about Irma. Let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way and come back, and we'll talk about Irma, about climate change, and a lot more.
Hi, I'm Nina Totenberg. Are you someone who talks about how great public radio is, but you're still not a donor? Rather than wait for the next pledge drive, you can support the programs you love by donating that unwanted vehicle. It's served you well over the years and can still get you around town, but let's face it, it's just taking up space. Donate it today. It could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station, and you could get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
I think we should introduce our panel today on the basis of whether they have power or not, starting with the people who don't. Todd Rehm, a Republican strategist and the editor of GeorgiaPundit.com, which you can get every day in your email. It's a great newsletter that tells you everything that's going on in state, federal, and local politics. Todd, how long have you been out without power now?
Since I've been sitting here, we passed the 48-hour mark, and that's 2 days without publishing my email. I hope to get back on that in the morning.
All right, all right. I should have given you a chance to make a pitch to the governor to have George Power come directly to your house. Beth Shapiro, Democratic, former Democratic strategist, now trying to live a life of retirement, but she was a longtime pollster and consultant for Democratic candidates. You lost power at all or no?
We lost it for 6 hours. We are feeling very thankful that we had what was a very minor inconvenience. We were fine.
And we welcome a new participant in our show today, Daniel Rochberg. He is an instructor in environmental science at Emory University. But when I look over your resume, you have a long background working with the State Department in Washington. You were involved in negotiations on a number of climate agreements. Including which ones?
Well, the run-up to the Paris Agreement in 2015, and specifically traveled for our delegation to way back in Bali in 2007 and Copenhagen in 2009.
And we should say you worked at state in under both George W. Bush and President Obama, so you had experience of both Republican and Democratic administrations to work for.
That's right. It's the joy of being a civil servant and a bureaucrat is you get to work for all teams, and it was a great experience, actually.
All right. You got your power back?
We did, last night about midnight, much to the surprise of my kids.
All right. So let's talk about Irma for a little bit. First of all, Daniel, since we have you here, there is still no confirmed science, although some people really would like to push it hard. To tell us whether climate change has any real impact on storms of the magnitude of Harvey and Irma. Am I right about that?
Yeah, the best way to think about it when this question comes up is the best analogy I've heard is like baseball and steroids. So if you have a slugger who hypothetically broke Hank Aaron's record, and if he were to have admitted to taking performance-enhancing drugs, the appropriate question is not, was home run number 756 or 500 or 300 due to use of some enhancement, but over the lifetime of your career, did you actually achieve that record for that reason? And the reason that analogy makes sense is what climate change appears to be doing is very much like adding steroids to our weather and our climate system. So you've got really two things that are against our favor when we think about hurricanes and climate change. One is that hurricanes love warmth. They love warmer air temperatures. They love warmer ocean temperatures. We have that in abundance right now. We had this year, 2017, the first half of 2017, Georgia, warmest on record again for Georgia. And we have sea surface temperatures that are about 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit above normal right now. And then the second thing you have is sea levels being higher. So on the Georgia coast, the Fort Pulaski gauge, last I checked, is about 10 inches above the historical levels in 1930. So that's about a foot. We're expecting potentially 1 to 4 more feet over the next century. So if you do end up with a storm that's on steroids, it's a bit stronger, a bit more intense, and you have a higher sea level to work with, you're looking at a lot more precipitation, a lot more wind, and you're looking at a lot more storm surge.
Yeah, so it certainly what we can say with some certainty, I guess, based on what you just said, is that presuming the climate change has had an impact on rising sea levels, which there isn't a great deal of disagreement about, is there?
No, there's not. Okay. And I think the same thing is true for temperature, where right now you've got the UN science body ascribing 95% certainty that we are the dominant cause of the increase in temperatures.
Well, I think there are, on a political side of that, Todd Rehm, there are certainly Republicans out there who argue quite vociferously that temperatures fluctuate up and down and that what Daniel just said is simply hyperbole.
There are Republicans who would contest that. In my mind, it's not that important to whether you believe or not. I think that, and we had this discussion a little bit earlier, I think we can all agree that producing less garbage is good. Producing less byproduct from the production of electricity, whether you're talking about particulate matter, whether you're talking about gaseous output, producing less byproduct is always good. And for those of us who base some of their objections to this idea on their faith, I think we're also called as people of faith to be good stewards of what's been given to us. And none of that requires me to believe one way or the other about global warming.
So that said, rising sea levels certainly make a huge difference when a storm like Irma comes in because it gives the water more, we're more vulnerable to surge.
That's exactly right. The data I've seen suggests that both Irma and Matthew, those two events, were the two highest levels ever recorded in the past 80 years of data. And so those are hurricane events, but on top of a rising sea level. That's right. Somebody, I think it was an MIT researcher, Carrie Emanuel, said about Sandy in New York that had the sea levels been a foot lower, they would have had 25 square miles less flooding in that area simply because of a lower base from which to have the storm surge.
All right. So let's talk about the politics of all this. Beth, as Harvey came in and now Irma, obviously there were a lot of questions being asked by people in the Trump administration, how they felt about whether climate change was having an impact on all this. Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, actually said, I'm not going to talk about that. This isn't an insensitive subject at a time like this.
Well, I'm sorry that his sensitivities were offended. It does seem like it's an appropriate question to raise when we saw a hurricane like Harvey, when we saw a hurricane like Irma, when we have the objective data showing that sea levels are rising, that temperatures are warming. So I do think that certainly we need to focus in the immediate response on helping people who have been hurt by the hurricane and help them get back on their feet. But I think we're capable of carrying more than one thought at one time. And I think that as we help people and as we ponder why we're in the situation that we're in, I think we can also be talking about the impact of climate change on weather patterns.
Well, Beth said that she thinks most of us can carry competing thoughts at the same time in our head, and I will tell you that after 2 days of no electricity, I find there are fewer neutrons firing in my brain at the time. I think the bigger point is not that how I would have said it is this is not a time to make political points on either side. This is not the time to score gotchas. If you are, and specifically for people who have some professional or factual knowledge to offer that and say, I just want to put a placeholder here that this is something we need to continue discussing, that's fine. It's people, and you see this among otherwise rational people saying, you know, oh, I hope this comes to bite so-and-so on the rump by washing out Mar-a-Lago or taking out all of their seaside developments in Sea Island. And that's what I think we should avoid, not necessarily discussing relevant facts, but using them as a bludgeon against the other side.
I think that's a great point, because we immediately go into our corners of I believe in science and climate change, and those are the climate change deniers, or this is all bunk and those people are crazy Al Gore followers. And we just it's amazing how quickly it happens. It's just in an instant that we're in our corners, and there's a whole lot of room in between the corners for us to be talking.
I love the fact that you said that, because Daniel, before we turn to in fact the way in which you're working to change the language of the conversation, I want to just quickly follow up on the Scott Pruitt question. It might have been easier to accept his deferral of the question if, in fact, his EPA hadn't already essentially banished the words climate change from official documents, done everything they could to wipe out any admission at all that there is such a thing as climate change. So it makes his response a little bit more disingenuous, perhaps.
I think that's it's a valid point. I think there is very much an issue of the messenger and their history. I did want to say it's great that the governor was able to spend some time today, and I do want to thank him and his team. He mentioned all these phenomenal team members, DNR, GEMA, GDOT, et cetera, and I think they really are doing a phenomenal job working their tails off trying to get around this. The other thing he said that I thought was really important in the context of this conversation is he said political considerations need to take a distant second seat. Of course, that was in the context of the budget discussion. But I think there's a point to be made here, which is exactly your point, and maybe that would have been better said by the administrator if he had said, listen, maybe we can just take a back seat from this particular issue right now. But I think, to Beth's point, one of the challenges and the binds we're in is that this is a politicized and polarizing topic, and that's really unfortunate, I think. That's not where we used to be, you know, if you go back to 2007 even, not so far ago, where we were able to get folks on the right and the left talking about this, and hopefully we can get back to a place where we can put politics aside and have a really practical conversation.
I'm not sure I actually agree with regards to 2007 having been any better of a place to discuss this. I had some clients in the environmental space trying to figure out how to speak Republican. And one of the things that I told them and that I showed them was that there was an underlying group then, as there is today, that just believes it's a bunch of malarkey. It's a bunch of one. It's all goes back to the one world government and all the other crazy theories. But they truly believe this. They didn't have a platform to make their beliefs known or to amplify their beliefs. Today they have that platform. 2007 they may have been. I don't think they were engaging in social media in build-it-yourself journalism at that time. They were out there. We just didn't know it, or a lot of people didn't know.
But I think, Daniel, you provided us with a PowerPoint that you presented that you present, I assume, to any number of organizations. And one of the things you reminded us all of, what that's in this presentation, excuse me, was that in 2008. I'd forgotten all about it, but nobody else at the table had. What did Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich do together?
So they did this great commercial. They were side by side on a couch in front of the U.S. Capitol. And to paraphrase, they basically said,
there's a lot of couches out in front of the Capitol.
Exactly. It's a
popular resting spot.
There's another in the series that was on a beach, I think. That was Al Sharpton and Pat Robertson, actually. Another. But this one, they said, you know, we don't agree on very much, but one thing we do agree on is that we need to work together to fight climate change.
So that's what you're talking about when you say there was a better atmosphere back then.
Right.
What happened in 2011? What did Newt Gingrich say about that ad?
Yeah, so when he was asked about where he had been, I think in essence he said that was the dumbest thing I ever did, that sitting on a couch with Nancy Pelosi. And I guess, Todd, I take your point that there have always been a wide range of views on this issue. What I have seem to have seen, even if you go back to George H.W. Bush running for president, one of his speeches he talked about very straightforwardly. He said, listen, as economies grow, they emit more carbon dioxide. That's warming the earth. It's not a liberal or a conservative issue. We just got to deal with it. So we had public, high-profile Republicans talking about it up until a certain point, and then it has become, I think, a much more polarized issue.
You know, I'm, My expertise is political science, which is a different kind of hot air. But what political science has taught me, and it's picking up on what Todd was talking about, is that there are ways to frame an issue. And if we would just set aside the language of the phrase climate change, and focus on a specific problem such as emissions, there are ways that that you can change people's behavior because it's in their own self-interest. You look at some local governments now use either hybrid vehicles or electric vehicles because it saves them money. It keeps keeps us from polluting the air. We can cut the number of smog alert days we have over the course of a summer. If we start to talk about the enlightened self-interest of engaging in specific behaviors, and don't put it in a frame of climate change, but put it in the frame of you're saving taxpayers' dollars, own dollars. Then I think we can start to get somewhere.
Beth's talking your language, Daniel. You're the head of the Georgia Climate Project. Tell us what, first, very briefly, what it is, and then let's talk about it in terms of that Beth just presented.
Sure. It's a team effort with colleagues from University of Georgia, from Georgia Tech, and we're branching out to several other schools. The idea of the Georgia Climate Project is, as you said, this is setting politics aside, and that's what academics can do, because you know, we're going to be coming at it from a nonpartisan, rather nerdy perspective. Setting politics aside, we need to be talking about this issue. We need to find a way to have a practical conversation. The whole vision of this is 5 years from now, people look at Georgia and say, where did they come from? They're actually talking about this in a way that I think doesn't work. You know, the California model is we're able to have one party sort of like take the issue and overwhelm the other one and rush ahead. Georgia, whether Georgia stays red, whether Georgia goes purple or blue, that model, I don't think, is going to work for Georgia. I don't think it's healthy for Georgia. We need to find a way as a state, and I love everything you guys are saying about how we need to find a way to have a conversation that runs through right and left, runs through faith and secular, runs through urban and rural. And that's the vision of the Georgia Climate Project, is for this group of academic institutions to work with partners, NGOs, private sector, government, to do our part to help support that conversation.
Todd, when Daniel talks about different language, yeah, I want to get you in here. Instead of climate change, he suggests maybe we use the phrase weather variability, I think. Is that you who said that, or is that one of your colleagues?
Yeah, it's come up a lot. You know, New York Times had a piece, they're talking to farmers, and, you know, they're definitely willing to talk about what the weather is doing to their crops. You know, here in Georgia, we had $800 million of losses in the ag sector due to the drought in 2007. We're seeing significant losses in the peach sector due to weather. And I think, Todd, you made this point, and Beth as well, we don't have to be talking about climate change per se to talk about those issues.
Well, I want to make three separate points. One is that it's worth noting that the 2011 walk back by Newt Gingrich of that commercial took place in the context of a Republican presidential primary in which he was being attacked for that ad.
Absolutely.
By folks supporting Mitt Romney. And so that being too green or something like that may at some level still be a dangerous position for a Republican to take. The second point is that hybrids are great. Electric cars are great. I've driven a couple of them, and they're a lot of fun. There are still a lot of people who don't like the subsidies.
We no longer have a subsidy.
Georgia got rid of the state subsidy several years ago. But there continues to be a federal subsidy.
Right.
There continue to be other industries that are highly subsidized. And there are those on the right who will attack those subsidies for a variety of other reasons that are not specifically related to environmental issues. But that's part of the background. And then third is that conservatives have become suspicious of anyone who wants to change what something is called because the old label has a bad connotation, which is so that liberals have quit calling themselves liberals and call themselves progressives, and now conservatives say, you're a progressive, that's because you're a liberal. And we all know that that's what that means. And so changing semantics has is in itself a red flag for some folks.
But I, first of all, what I thought I heard you say, Beth, was talking about when you talk about electric cars, fuel efficient vehicles, I thought you were talking about a mindset. I thought you were talking beyond the actual practicality of an alternative fuel vehicle and talking about how we can start shifting thinking among even those who think dealing with climate change is a dangerous political position, but this is a way to get at it, beginning of a way to get at it.
Right. I'm not saying that we change the language in terms of discussing climate change. I'm just saying set the phrase aside and focus on human behavior, because ultimately that's what this is all about, is that I believe that our behaviors are contributing, are the major contributor to what's going on. And if it is human behavior that's doing that, then let's talk about the behaviors that we can change, but perhaps we don't talk about them in the context of climate change. We present other reasons why it's helpful to change those behaviors, particularly economic reasons.
I think that's right, and I think fundamentally that's probably a better place to go. Rather than, you know, even fighting over changing terminology, the conversation that I think we should be having as a state, you know, there's one conversation about the global issue, and there's a moral issue there. There really is, about the least, those who have done least to cause the problem are most affected by it. But even if we just look within Georgia's narrow self-interest, which is an important lens, there's an issue of both minimizing economic risks, and there are very real risks, and also, on the flip side, maximizing economic opportunities. There is, you know, the unambiguous signal from the global community right now is, to solve this problem, we have to have literally net zero emissions by the end of the century. Like right now, I don't think any of us live in a net zero emissions building. I certainly don't. It's quite aspirational, but we're talking about a planet of 10 or 11 billion people having no emissions by the end of the century. It's a huge lift. But what that means is that's a market signal that's pretty powerful, that there's a clean energy future to be won. And I think there's a very interesting nonpartisan or multipartisan conversation to be had in the state about what are we doing to win that clean energy future? Can clean energy be the film industry or the next film industry for Georgia, where we're recruiting and retaining and building businesses in a way that just makes market sense? And on the flip side, we need to be thinking, as the coast really has been. I mean, there's work by the folks at Georgia Marine Extension and Sea Grant on adaptation plans for Tybee Island and for St. Mary's. They are really grappling with, they don't care what they call it, they're grappling with very real risks to their property and their economy and their livelihoods. And that's also part of the conversation we need to have.
What I would say is that we in Georgia have been having that conversation over the past several years with respect to such things as the build-out of solar, whether that should be part of the major utilities portfolio. But in the bigger picture, the largest debate that will be taking place that combines the economic questions, the issues of jobs, the issues of emissions, is going to be the decision whether to continue building Plant Vogtle or not.
Well, they've essentially made that decision, right? I mean, we now know that George Power wants to commit to moving forward on it. Is nuclear power, you want to finish that, Ted?
Georgia Power has made their decision.
Yeah.
And that's not the final word.
Well, right.
Are you saying the PSC might actually step in? And
I'm saying there's at least a formality to be had.
Okay. What about that, Daniel? Nuclear power is an alternative. I mean, with it, this will be, if as you know, if Plant Vogtle continues its construction, it will be the only new nuclear power plant under construction in the United States.
Yeah, it's a, you know, the issue, as you all know, and I'd love to hear your thoughts as well, Beth and Bill, is that the issue has bedeviled in the environmental movement for decades, right? Because on one hand, you have the classic risks of what if there is an accident? What do you do with the waste? Are we worried about proliferation? And that really came to the fore viscerally, I think, for this generation after Fukushima. And that really caused a lot of second guessing. On the flip side, there's some very impressive arguments in favor of Vogtle coming out from the former Secretary of Energy, Ernie Moniz, Marilyn Brown, locally here at Georgia Tech, and obviously Tim Echols and others on the Public Service Commission. And there's some very compelling points being made about other factors like national security and economic security. If we shutter Vogtle, then we have literally zero new construction, as you said, Bill. And what does that mean for our ability to play in a global marketplace? And also to play in a global security environment where other countries still are actively pursuing the technology, which means they're developing and maintaining the workforce that's able to work in it. So it's a it's not an easy issue, to be sure. I think that there are very strong arguments being made in favor of it, both for environmental and national security reasons, but also equally you're seeing folks on the other side say, you know, that's, there's risks that are a bit too big to stomach.
And to Beth's point, what it really comes down to is a question of paying for it. The company has said, under these conditions, we wish to proceed. And it's not just one company making that decision. They've got a coalition of co-owners that have to be kept on board, and it's all going to come down to what's the cost going to be to the ratepayer, what's the cost or benefit going to be to the shareholder or to the EMC membership, and how loudly is one or another of those groups screaming. And part of the current environment is we haven't heard the kind of complaints about the upfront payment towards Vogtle. It hasn't been as strident in the last couple years as it was in 2010, 2011, when it was always being discussed.
All right, we've got to get to a break in a minute. But before we do, Beth Shapiro, I know you want to get a word in, and you will have a chance to do that. But let's finish off this particular part of our conversation. Daniel, I think I'm right in saying, look, we acknowledge that Georgia is a very red state, and there is not likely going to be action by our Republican legislature on dealing with legislation that will reduce carbon emissions and all the things that contribute to climate change. Part of what your concern is, I believe, is the extra legislative, extra legal, extra government things that can be done to make a difference. Is that right?
I think that's right. One issue is, will the political stars align in Georgia, Republican or Democrat, where folks at the leadership level or the legislature or across the state say, we really want to move on this issue? When that happens, we want them to have a really phenomenal network of experts to turn to who say, great, I'm glad you asked, I've thought about this, et cetera. Then the second issue is what can be done to help support the stars aligning going forward through, again, the sort of nonpartisan approach that we really want to take. And the idea is that we can do three things. We can strengthen the scientific base, so make sure that that information is out there. We just completed an effort with experts across the state to come up with a climate research roadmap. The question: what are the top 40 questions, which, if we can answer them, are going to help policymakers or researchers? The second thing is we're doing our part to support conversations on what does our energy future look like. We want to build a community of practice of all these communities across the state who are trying to grapple with dealing with the impact. So the Coast, Atlanta Regional Commission is doing great work. I think the ag community probably has a lot of self-interest in getting into that. So can we build a community of practice where these folks just learn from each other? All of this, the ethos of this is to get into the practical details of why does it matter for us and what do we do about
it? But also, Beth, and you're going to get the last word before the break, the private sector has an impact here. We know that there are an increasing number of corporations that are choosing to build headquarters, other infrastructure that is energy efficient, that reduces carbon emissions. So it isn't as if everything has to be done by government.
There are also a lot of private sector decisions are being made about location of companies, and there's a growing number of them that are locating near MARTA lines because they want their employees to be able to not have to drive. So no, I think it's we're all in this together. Whether it's local government, and I would tip my hat to City of Atlanta in particular for a lot of the steps it's taken to address sustainability and to reduce its footprint in terms of climate change. So it's local government, state government, it's the private sector. But it's also each of us as individuals. We can, each of us can have an impact on this.
All right. As we go to break, a little behind the political rewind scene secret. We've talked about Tim Echols, the Public Service Commissioner, a couple of times. He's been on the show, as people who listen regularly know. Tim Echols drives an electric car, and he sits here in our studio and keeps consulting his watch because he knows just how much of a charge he has left on the car that's sitting over at a Georgia Tech power station. So we lose him early sometimes when he thinks he's not going to have any power left in his car. Just a little behind-the-scenes look at Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
on the next Fresh Air, the risk of nuclear war with North Korea. We talk with New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos, who spent 4 days in Pyongyang last month, where he says talk of nuclear war is everywhere, including on TV and billboards. We'll talk about why this has become an especially risky time and where it might lead. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3, right here on GPB.
We're back with Beth Shapiro, Todd Rehm, and Daniel Rochberg from Emory University and the Georgia Climate Project. Let's turn to a few other political issues in the news. Beth, on this show a few weeks back, Johnny Isaacson came in, Senator Isaacson, and it was shortly after Charlottesville and the controversy over President Trump blaming the disruptions from people on many sides. Senator Isaacson was very plain spoken. He said, this is a president who should have spoken out sooner and more unequivocally. Now, he has been one of the leads on a piece of legislation that's passed both the House and Senate. It is a, essentially, it's a proclamation. What do we call it? I'm blocking.
Joint resolution.
A resolution. Thank you. A joint resolution calling on the White House to devote more resources to tracking hate crimes and to making unequivocal statements about the need to crack down on extremist groups in this country. The president can either sign it or not.
Well, I think people from many sides in Congress came together to state what many of us think is the obvious. Perhaps they would have done this, irrespective of what the president had said. I think that it was done as a rebuke to the president. Perhaps if you weren't spending so much time insulting the leaders of the Senate and the House, then the members of these two bodies might be more inclined to, might be less inclined to feel like they had to take steps like this.
Todd?
Well, one of the things I've learned about President Trump during his term of office is that he does not, I don't think, respond very kindly to suggestions about how he ought to comport himself. I think there is a time at which I'm not sure how much more we have to just bash the guy for saying something that we wish had been stronger. I just don't believe that moves anything forward except makes some congressmen, I don't know, feel like they've done something.
Well, I would throw out an alternative theory on this. You're right, the president has not shown a great deal of interest in listening to what people ask him to do, but I would suggest that if I were a Republican, I would have voted for this measure because it does give the president an opportunity to once and for all put this issue behind him by signing this joint resolution.
I think it's extraordinary that we even have to have a conversation about the president not knowing what's appropriate to say at a time like what happened in Charlottesville. And I think what's also been extraordinary is that some members of his own party, some at some risk, have felt the need to say, well, this just wasn't what you should have said. This just didn't go as far as it should have.
All right, but
so I think that's reflective of the moment that we're in.
All right, but got to say it's interesting that it was Johnny Isaacson here in Georgia who felt strongly about this and wanted to be one of the leaders in getting this joint resolution to the president. Todd, Chuck and Nancy are going to be at the White House for dinner with the president tonight. You know, I don't know if you've had this experience, but when I was a young guy dating, if a girl that I was really interested in, I knew she was on a date with some other guy, I would spend that whole evening just really worrying about what they were doing. I can't help but wonder if that's how Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan are going to think about tonight.
I think that one of the things that leadership in the Senate is going to learn eventually, leadership in the House and other folks, is that they can get a lot more done by getting to work and ignoring what the president says, and then when they have some legislation or when they have something to present to him, take it to him and tell him that we took your great idea and did it, and will you please sign it? I think that for years, conservatives some conservatives have hoped for a lessening of the imperial nature of the United States presidency. And now we've got this great opportunity. I'm not saying ignore what President Trump wants in policy matters, in personnel matters, what he actually substantively does. But you can't ignore a lot of the sideshow and just get to work. So, you know, I don't think Mitch McConnell is going to be losing a whole lot of sleep at this
point. I think Todd is exactly right that I think if I were McConnell or Ryan, I would be moving my agenda through, and that's exactly what I would do. I wouldn't tell the president it's a great idea. I would tell him this is a tremendous idea that came from you, and we have now enacted it into law, and all we need you to do is sign it.
And you know who is the master of this, who is absolutely killing it on that measure? Jeff Sessions. He's coming out with actual policy and saying, Mr. President, this is what you were talking about. Let's go ahead and do it. And sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't what I think I heard the president say. Sessions is really doing a great job, especially given how hard he came under fire. The fact that he just kept plugging away. And while I differ with him on some of these specific measures, civil asset forfeiture, medicinal use of marijuana, while I disagree with him, I certainly do admire the get-to-work nature that he has shown.
That, to me, that might be the only thing that's admirable about what he's doing, because from a substantive standpoint, I think he's doing a great deal of damage to a lot of communities in the country. But I think Todd is exactly right. He's learned how to adapt to working for someone as mercurial as President Trump.
Okay, I want to throw out two thoughts about the about this Trump outreach to Democratic leaders. One is, during the earliest stages of the healthcare debate, several of us on this show said, President Trump has a wonderful opportunity here. Why should he marginalize Democrats in Congress? He's not really a Republican. Wouldn't it be phenomenal if he, in fact, reached out to Democrats and said, we'll work with you to help pass a health care bill that improves on Obamacare, whatever language he wants. There was a lot of talk about Trump being in a good position to have a bipartisan outreach, and it didn't happen. It strikes me that now that it's happening, given his behavior and conduct over the first months of his tenure, who knows where it's going, but isn't there some reason to think this is a good thing? And where have we gotten to when there's outrage on one party's part because the president dares talk to the other party?
Well, here's the reality of the situation. Loathe is probably the weakest word I could use to talk about how the Democratic base feels toward this president.
I know.
So I hope Chuck and Nancy enjoy their dinner, and maybe they bring home a souvenir napkin or a book of matches or something. But they're going to be constrained. They can only go but so far working with the president. So I think, you know, the same was true for Republicans working with President Obama.
They can go as far as they're able to get some concessions that will please their base. Chuck Schumer's already said that he's not going to go for tax cuts that the Trump administration might approve that are for the rich, not for Americans of lower income brackets. So why not work for what you can get? That's what happened in the debt ceiling deal.
I agree that Democratic leadership is constrained by their membership, as it is with any party leadership. The reason, if I were Mitch McConnell, I wouldn't be losing sleep over this is because they'll get burned too. And we have yet to see a political actor have a lasting working relationship with President Trump,
right,
beyond Jeff Sessions. And I think the more I think about it, the more I think he's the guy to watch, because he's going to get stuff done. And Mike Pence, what do we know that he's doing or not doing? But Pence is surely one of the more sophisticated operators in Washington, D.C. And silence from him might be something, if I were a Democrat, I'd be worried about.
All right. We were going to talk about Steve Bannon in his 60 Minutes interview, but we ran out of time. We had a good discussion about climate change, which seemed to me to be more pertinent and meaningful. Maybe on Friday's show, we'll get to that Bannon interview, which was really kind of remarkable in its own way. I wanted to say, Daniel, it's been a pleasure to have you here. And I talked to Jim Galloway a while ago. You're in his column tomorrow, I understand. Jim's writing about the fact that over the last 3 weeks, he considers Harvey and Irma the best political ad against federal cuts to the country's meteorological operations and for the recognition of climate change. And the budget would cut a lot of the weather services operations if it goes through as conceived.
It would. A lot of the fundamental research into looking at our climate, a lot of the great work that our Sea Grant folks are doing on the coast, and a lot of our clean energy research and development, which we desperately need going forward if we're going to solve this problem.
All right. Daniel Rochberg, we appreciate your being here today. Come back and see us again. It was fun to have you on the show.
Thanks a ton for having me.
Todd Rehm, always glad to have you here. Thank you. I hope, please, let's get Todd's power back on. He needs it for that three-car garage that every family in Brookhaven has, right?
Absolutely.
Excuse me. And Beth Shapiro, we love having you here. Thanks so much for joining us today. I apologize. I know my voice has been a little raw. I hope you were able to put up with it today. Tomorrow on Two-Way Street at 2 o'clock, we were kind of hit hard by Irma Hoot here, as well as everybody at home. Well, not as hard as the people who lost things, but it certainly blew a hole in our production schedule. So tomorrow we've picked a show that we all loved that we ran some time ago last spring with the great, great author George Saunders, the MacArthur Genius Grant recipient, one of the country's finest short story, an essayist. And we talked to him about his first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, which is already being called a masterpiece by the critics. So we're going to have that great conversation with George Saunders on Two-Way Street tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And then, of course, we're back with you on Friday for another edition of Political Rewind. We're on the air at 3 o'clock, as you know, for the Friday edition of the show. Thank you to Olivia Rheingold, to Tyler Morris, to Jenny Ament for your work on the show today. And we'll see you all again on the next, Two-Way Street, tomorrow at 2. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening.